There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ahí va a llegar el gol del Arsenal. Ozil marca. Mesut Ozil.
Bellerín, otro defensor, otro disparo. Monreal, gol. Marca el futbolista español. Marca Nacho Monreal. Pim pam pum.
This is Arscast Extra.
Hello and welcome to another Arscast Extra, as always, with James from Gunnerblog. James, goodly morning to you.
Goodly morning to you too. Goodly Monday morning at long last.
Yeah, it is. A lot of people have been digging the old Sunday evening podcasts, getting some good feedback on that. So
yeah,
we're back to normal though.
We're back to normal. Who knows? Maybe we'll switch it up more in future. But I like routine. I find it strange when I don't do this on a Monday morning. You know, it's become part of my life.
Wow. profound way to start the podcast.
Do you know,
go on.
I know. No, just talking about profundity and this podcast. I did a tweet last night saying, hey guys, we've got the podcast tomorrow. We're back on Monday morning. It's the Interlal, so any sort of topics you might have that you think we should chat about or anything like that, you know, questions, send them in. And a good chunk of the replies I got were, probably don't bother, nothing's happened, so don't bother.
Oh, well, thanks very much for that.
and yet here we are. So that's commitment, if nothing else.
It is indeed. Actually, I must see if I can find this here. There was a guy, yesterday I did a post about double barrel names at Arsenal, and my intention was to make it ludicrous because there's so little going on. I was going to like do a couple like Ainsley Maitland-Niles and Emile Smith-Rowe, and then I realised we actually had quite a few. So there's Jordi Osei-Tutu in there as well, Tyrese John-Jules, and so it became there was a little less scope for me to be ridiculous because I was just going to make up some stupid names, which I did towards the end with the French boy Francois Voyage. And the Irish guy, I think it was Seamus Murphy McGee. But I got a comment on Facebook. Where is it here? From a guy called James on Facebook, not you, definitely. He said, would it kill you to do some proper journalism / reporting? There you go. Nice to get feedback, isn't it?
It is good. I mean, do you know what's the sort of saddest aspect of this is that I think I've tried to make this point about double-barreled names in seriousness before on this podcast. I'm pretty sure that I was like, yeah, there's a lot more double-barreled names these days. It's I don't know if anyone's noticed, but you know, it was around the time Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain was coming through. I was like, it's the future, guys, the double-barreled midfielder.
Well, we've got plenty. We've had plenty as well. I'd forgotten all about Oxlade-Chamberlain. I'm sure there's been some others who've gone as well, so...
It's the modern world, Andrew, isn't it?
It is. Are people just being greedy about having names, or are parents indecisive, or is it?
It comes from the clubs. It comes from the clubs because they want to make more money on shirt printing.
Oh, smart thinking.
So they think if we give our child, parents think if we give our child a double-barreled surname, he'll be more valuable to any football club.
Mm.
Football clubs are going around hoovering up all the double-barreled six-year-olds and hoping to turn them into footballers. On the basis that it will be more profitable exercise if they make it.
Yeah. Well,
so we criticised, you know, Gazidis and his regime, but the influx of double barrel players will do wonders for our bank balance.
Ivan Gazidis. That's his new name at AC Milan.
So good, they named him once. So I mean, look, you've got to make the best of what you got. I think that's I had that on the agenda for today, double-barreled surnames. I think that's, you know, serious football chat as far as I'm concerned.
Well,
right now.
Okay, well, we've done that. So what else?
What about the Nations League? Come on, have you embraced the Nations League? I'm an Englishman, so I think it's terrific competition.
Terrific.
I think it's probably more important than the World Cup, I would say, based on the last few months.
I was staggered to find out there were finals next summer.
It's a hell of a weight, isn't it?
It surely is. But what do you win? What do you win? Do you get, like, vouchers for TK Maxx or something? I don't know what you win. Is there a Nations League trophy? I can hear you frantically Googling this.
This was
some feedback we got the other week as well, wasn't it? About you frantically Googling things as we talk on the podcast. But
well, I don't prepare before, do I? That would be crazy. But I the reason is I want to check what I thought, which is that I thought that you qualified for the Euros if you won automatically. But maybe that's incorrect. I don't know.
I did look at the link this morning, like, how does it work and how does it affect European Championship qualification? And I sat there, and in fairness, it was about 6:10 this morning when I was sitting writing the blog, and I was trying to read it, and it was just... Do you ever read something and it just doesn't make any sense to you at all?
Yeah.
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 It was like that.
If a group winner has already qualified via the European qualifiers, their spot will go to the next best ranked.
Yeah, I read all this, but, like... It just seems unnecessarily complicated.
It does seem unnecessarily complicated. I mean, what I understand is that it's very much here to stay, that a lot of that UEFA are fully behind this idea, you know, it's their baby. And a lot of the international FAs apparently feel quite positively about it as well. I mean, presumably the English FA will after their relative success in
Ireland.
Their group.
Ireland won't. Ireland got relegated to where? I don't know. Are we relegated outside of Europe?
Yes. Yes, you are, yeah.
You're now a part of Antarctica.
CONCACAF or something. I don't know. It's a complicated one, but I do think that it has sort of lent the veneer of competitiveness to these international games, and I think they slightly benefit from it. I mean, I'm someone who can't get excited about international friendlies at all. I mean, they are a waste of time to me, you know, because I'd rather be watching club football and I'd rather be watching competitive football. And these are at least, you know, the kind of illusion of competitive. Well, there is something at stake. There is something at stake in terms of a new competition and in terms of it does affect, I think, your sort of seeding and your qualifying. So I quite like it. I quite like it. And it's brought out some very good games, actually. And the game with Croatia, between England and Croatia, was... A decent one. No Arsenal involvement, though, sadly, of course, with Danny Welbeck being injured.
Yeah, he is. He is, and he's about our only English player, isn't he?
Yeah, I guess.
Well, I mean, English international. Until, you know, Smith Rowe and Nkediah and all these guys, make the step up. Yeah.
Do you think... we had a question, I think, a couple of weeks ago that I remember seeing, where someone said, do you think Rob Holding, are you surprised he's not been in contention for the England squad?
Not particularly, because I think what we've seen with Rob Holding is a player who has definitely made some improvement this season, but also in a team which is defensively a little bit suspect as well. And it is only 12 games in, and what he's been a fixture for maybe the last 7 or 8. So maybe, I mean, who are England's central defensive options? I know there's John Stones.
John Stones played yesterday with Joe Gomez, who was really good, yeah. I thought.
Harry Maguire is there as well, isn't he, with his gigantic head.
Yeah,
he's there.
I think Dunk was in the squad for this one.
He's from Brighton, is he?
Brighton, yeah. Lewis Dunk. I think he was in the squad. But, I mean, I think Rob Holding... I agree with you. You know, I think he's not really... He's done okay for us, but it's not like we're watertight. And also, I sort of... You know, I am an England fan, I guess, and I am an Arsenal fan, and I want to see...
Yeah.
I'd prefer to watch Arsenal players in the English team, but then when they're so young in the kind of crucible of their career, sometimes I think it's not the worst thing for them to be out of the limelight. And... I always am quite relieved that Alex Iwobi didn't declare for England. You know, I sort of think that there's such intense pressure on the international team that I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing for them to be able to develop away from that spotlight.
Sometimes, though, it's difficult for a player to make the grade at international level, despite being a really good club player. There might be a generation of other players in that position who are just considered ahead of you. So you think about, for example, Steve Bould, who is a really excellent player, but he only... Did he get two caps or something for England? I know he got a couple for England B, and, you know, even someone like, I mean, how many England caps did Lee Dixon get? I think it was a surprisingly small amount when you consider, let's see here, 22 England appearances for, you know, one of the most consistent defenders and one of the best back fours in English football at that time. But he played, who else was around at that time? Paul Parker, maybe? Who else?
Well, towards the end, Gary Neville, I suppose.
Yeah.
It's overlapping. I was talking about right backs in the 90s for England.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think who was in that back four. Paul Parker was.
Gary Stevens?
Quite a few times.
Gary Stevens?
I don't remember Gary Stevens. The manager would have been sort of Graham Taylor, wouldn't it, in this period?
Yeah.
Sort of mid-90s when Dixon was at his peak. Glenn Hoddle.
I think it was Paul Parker and Gary Stevens, who played for Everton, were the ones, and then maybe Gary Neville as well.
Gary Neville was in by Euro 96, so that would have been like the latter part, the sort of Arsene Wenger period of Dixon's career.
And the same with Nigel Winterburn to an extent where, you know, again, a really dependable player at club level, but because of Stuart Pearce, Graham Lasso, Tony DiRigo.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't get did he get any England caps, Nigel Winterburn?
I'm not sure that he did. Have a look.
I will frantically Google here.
Frantically Google.
Two.
Two, yeah. It's not many, is it? Martin Keown, I think, probably got the most out of that set, with the exception of Tony Adams and David Seaman. But even he was never really a first choice pick for England. He was someone who would either be brought in to do a specialist man marking job sometimes in a back three, or, you know, as a replacement for someone who was injured. So, I mean, there was definitely a debate, wasn't there, at the time, of, you know, Arsenal have got this amazing defensive unit, they're all English, why not just play them?
Yeah.
But, you know, international football rarely does that, surprisingly. No. I mean, when they do, it does tend to work. Look at, you know, the Spanish teams that were made up primarily of Barcelona players, etc. But yeah, it didn't happen in the 90s with England.
No. So there
By the
you
way,
go.
I have actually, think, discovered what the impact of the Nations League is on Euro 2020 qualifying.
Okay.
So, in short, what it means, apart from the fact that the nations who've in the semi-finals get a load of money, they get about £3 million each, I think, for competing in those semi-finals next summer. And they also, as a consequence of playing the semi-finals, their fixture list for the qualifiers is compressed, because they'll be spending some of the time, other nations will be doing the qualifying, they will be competing in the Nations League in the semi-finals. So rather than going into groups of six teams, they will go into groups of five teams. So theoretically, they face a shorter path to the European Championships. And should they fail to qualify via those means, they have guaranteed themselves a place in the playoffs. So they could do absolutely sod all in the qualifiers, but they'll still be in the playoffs to qualify for the European Championships the following summer.
Right. I heard every word you said, but it still made no sense to me whatsoever.
That's absolutely reasonable. Oh, and Arsenal, Ireland have been relegated to CONCACAF. Yeah, I checked that.
We have. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to some warm weather games.
Some lovely away days.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. Well, look, that's what's been going on at international level. We haven't had any reports of injuries for our players, which is good. No. That's always the thing that we look out for. You know what, though? I feel slightly... Oh, God, I'm going to jinx the shit out of us here.
I can't believe you're going to do this.
I am.
Okay.
I'm going to do it. That, let's say 2 years ago or 3 years ago, every time there was an international break, injuries felt inevitable, didn't they? At least somebody would get injured or pick up a knock or a strain or something. And I don't feel the same sense of trepidation anymore when our players go away on international duty. Whether that's because there are fewer of them now, which I think seems to be the case, or some of the ones that go away aren't as crucial to our team as they have been in the past. Like, with all due respect to Mohamed Elneny, if he got an injury, does it make that much difference to us from a Premier League point of view, considering he hasn't played a minute of Premier League football. You know, it has an impact on our squad depth, but not necessarily the first team. So I wonder, is it a little bit of that, but more because our players are perhaps a little more resilient, that their fitness and the work that's been done on the training ground has made them, dare I say it, a little bit more robust.
Maybe. I mean, one thing that I have been thinking over the past week, and it's not, I don't think it's an original observation, but we've been talking about the England squad and the lack of players in it. Mm. It does seem that we had a particularly injury-prone clutch of English players, doesn't it? I mean, you know, when you think back, sort of Kieran Gibbs, Jack Wilshere, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, Danny Welbeck, Carl Jenkinson, these were all players who've been cursed, really, with huge injuries. And they've sort of gone now. I think we have sort of lost a lot of the more injury-prone players from within the squad. And then some of the ones that we still have, I mean, Aaron Ramsey's one I'd point out, maybe their roles have diminished within the first team squad. So with less anxiety, with less anxiety around their fitness. But yeah, it does seem like there's a little bit less stress. I think we probably should give some credit to Darren Burgess and his team as well. But I do think it's partly about personnel. I just think, you know, when you're carrying someone like a Jack Wilshere in your squad, there is always that worry of, you know, is he gonna crumple at any point? But we've shed a lot of that now. But it is nice. I mean, I'm trying to think of other players who actually played in the international break and seem to have come through unscathed. I know Socratis played for Greece. I know Xhaka played in a big win for Switzerland.
5-2 against Belgium.
Mm.
They're missing Thierry Henry's management skills there.
They really are. They really are. There was one of those articles, you know how, I think it was The Mirror, would do an article saying, like, find out what Arsenal fans have been saying about Granit Xhaka's performance against Belgium. And I was like, well, I haven't seen the game, so I will actually click on that and see what it is they've been saying. And it turned out all they've been saying was stuff like, oh, he's been booked again. What a surprise. So that's all I could really glean.
Well, in fairness, it serves you right.
I know. I was baited and I clicked.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like you were going to get some genius piece of insight.
I thought it was going to be, you know, like it's a tactical analysis of his commanding central midfield performance.
In 280 characters or less, you know.
It was just like, he's been butsy and wanker, stuff like that. So,
Look, he does get booked quite a lot. He's one game away from suspension in the Premier League because he's got 4 yellow cards this season. But he says, actually this week, he said that this is the best season of his life so far. And he's waxed lyrical about Unai Emery and the work that he's been doing on the training ground. Where's the bit here where he talks about the video analysis? Video analysis of the opposition. A freak.
A freak, yes.
He's a freak who pushes us back and forth 10 times until everyone understands what they're doing. Just leaving a gap there so you can go in with a joke there about Mustafi needing to do it 20 times or something. You know, Anyway, he says, you know, the tactics change for every game depending on the opposition. And Xhaka says, the first video analysis follows right after the game. And then it goes on every day, 30 minutes of video on the game day after breakfast. And then again, before we go to the game. So they're all sitting there on their iPads watching videos of the opposition, the way the opposition move, how to break down the opposition, how to find their weak spots, etc., etc. Do you wonder...
Stuffy's just playing Candy Crush in the corner, hoping no one notices.
But do you wonder, like, what if we didn't have this? What would our season be like? Like, the last couple of games, last couple of weeks have been a bit rubbish. You know, we've won 1 from 5 and the games have been a bit... which is, you know, inevitable, I think. But where would we be without this marginal gain that the video analysis on the iPads gives us? Maybe that's the difference. Maybe we'd have lost one or two of those games without this movie maker extraordinaire as manager of Arsenal. He's like the Alfred Hitchcock of football management, but less stabby.
Do you think his Unai Emery's videos are like, YouTube compilations, you know, like set to terrible European music, dance music.
Does your phone do that? My phone does this. So if you go yesterday, for example, went to beach with the dogs.
Yeah.
Went to the beach and my phone this morning says your new movie is ready. And I've taken some pictures of the dogs and stuff and they're running around and it's made a movie of my pictures with some really terrible guitar music, like 23-second
right
video.
And you haven't asked for it. It's just done it of its
own
accord.
Just done it for me.
Because the robots are taking over.
Exactly. Your new movie. What movie? I didn't make a movie, you goddamn phone fucker. But
it's like when you go on Facebook and they're like, you have been friends with this man you've never met for 10 years. We've made a compilation video about your friendship. Do you get those? And it's like a montage of, you know, times you've liked each other's posts set to soppy music.
I have seen those. I don't tend to go on Facebook very much apart from on the Arse Blog page.
Right.
To read what mean things people are saying about the stuff I write, of course. But yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Imagine if that's what Emery's videos are like. Just random clips of who are we playing next? Bournemouth. Just random clips of whoever the fuck who plays for Bournemouth these days? I can't even remember. Not Jack Wilshere, anyway.
Callum Wilson. He's in the England squad.
Exactly. Random clips of him and that little guy. What's his name? Fraser? You know,
yeah.
The little short guy. He's kind of like the English Shaqiri in that he looks like a barrel with legs.
That is a perfect comparison. He looks quite a lot like Shaqiri, actually.
Yeah.
That's very astute. Yes, Ryan Fraser, Scotland winger.
Oh, right. Okay, well, there you go.
Yeah.
So, look, I presume his videos are a bit more... He's probably got some you know, captions in Comic Sans and stuff.
Do you think he's done things like he's sort of flipped all the footage because of rights reasons and stuff like that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean? Like it's very slightly compressed. He cuts the top off it just in case his YouTube channel gets nixed by the Premier League and their robot algorithms, yeah.
I mean, it's quite interesting, I guess, to sort of hear a bit of specificity on how it actually works and when they're watching these videos. And it surprises me that it's that close to the game. I mean, you'd think players would be sort of focused on other types of preparation by that point. But I guess the game's come so thick and fast. If you're going to do it, you've got to squeeze it in somewhere, especially with the Europa League. You know, if you get back on whatever it is, Friday morning, and you've got a game on the Sunday, you've got to watch, you've got to fit that footage in somewhere. But as for your question as to like how bad would we be without it, it's really difficult, isn't it? Because we don't actually know how much it helps. Like, we like the idea of it, but it's difficult to know what kind of tangible impact it might have. I mean, you know, Granit Xhaka, presumably there were videos that said things like, don't dummy a ball needlessly in the middle of midfield, but...
Maybe there wasn't. Maybe that's the problem.
I know what he's going to be watching when he gets back. Just loads of videos of incidents like that. Don't do this. I don't know. It's kind of... Xhaka compared Emery to, I think it's Lucien Favre, is it?
Yeah.
Who was his coach at Borussia Mönchengladbach, who is also like a known sort of fanatic with an eye for detail. And I think as Arsenal fans, we really welcome that because it feels like a counterpoint to what we've had in the past. It's a really radically different approach. But what would be fascinating would be to hear players talking specifically about how that's helped them, really. I'd love to know more, but inevitably there's going to be a sort of a slight wall of silence on that, isn't there? You know, you're not going to reveal your methodology so early on.
Yeah. I mean, can't be that complicated, though, can it?
No. I mean, it's an editing job, isn't it?
Mm.
That's the main thing I keep thinking is that someone... Because presumably these videos, there's like team videos, I would think, but there must also be like positionally tailored ones. You know, if you're a fullback... There must be videos that are like, here's Ryan Fraser.
This is where he likes to, this is the way he likes to turn. Show him inside.
Etc.
And that.
Etc.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I imagine there are sort of like big, you know, I imagine the words show him inside come up like, you know, in big letters at some point in the video to sort of reinforce the message.
Yeah, for people who don't like to, you know, look at the pictures, they only like to, you know, read the captions.
I think it would be great, wouldn't it, if, I mean, not great, but it would be fascinating if some of that footage was leaked, wouldn't it? I mean, that would be like, if you could tell me you could see something from behind the scenes at Arsenal, I'd love to watch I'd love to watch what they're watching. Not because it would make me a better footballer, but just because I'm nosy.
Yeah. Yeah, I do wonder. I mean, is it mandatory watching? Do they sit down? Do they have a cinema room at London Colney?
They definitely do, yeah. They have a suites with projectors in.
Right.
And big screens. But I don't know whether they're doing this collectively or individually. Mm. I imagine both.
Yeah, well, look, I guess it will speak to some players. For other players, they might get, you know, a little bit cheesed off at watching videos.
What do you make of Xhaka's analysis that he's having the best season of his life? Do you think he's having his best season at Arsenal, either?
Weirdly, I would say, yeah. Mm. I would say he probably is, even though he just made that big mistake against Wolves. I think generally he's been pretty good this season. He's done a job for us at left back, which shows not so much a versatility, but a willingness to do a job he's been asked to do, which has taken him out of his comfort zone. It's affected the team, but you know we didn't have anyone else to play there, so he was happy to do it. I thought he was really good against Liverpool alongside Torreira, not so great against Wolves, but I think the mistake overshadowed everything else, really, you know? That's what tends to happen. I think we've spoken about this before, that sometimes a player can do 99 things well and do one thing wrong and everyone remembers the one thing. And I think he's kind of that kind of a player. You know, for a lot of people, they're just kind of waiting for him to make a mistake. And unfortunately, he tends to oblige a bit too often. But I do think, generally speaking, he is playing his best football, which may have something to do with the fact that as a team, there's a lot less baggage around us. You know, where Wenger's last season was just crazy, really. It was hard to make any real assessment of any individual because of how weird we were collectively. You know, we were really good at home and just shit away. So there was something really wrong fundamentally with the team for, you know, his second season at Arsenal. His first season, I think every player gets a bit of a pass, don't they? You know, it takes him a season to settle in. He had some good moments, some bad moments. So from an Arsenal point of view, I think so far it is his best season, but I think it could be better as well.
Well, that's promising though, isn't it? Because isn't he someone who we've observed over the past couple of years tends to start relatively slowly and finish quite strongly. And given that he started the season decently enough, you can project forward and think maybe by the end of the season he will be playing certainly his best football. And the other thing to say is that over the past couple of years, you're right, there were a lot of mitigating factors that kind of impinge on any analysis of any player. But I think he particularly was hung out to dry from a tactical perspective in this Arsenal team. You know, I think he was given an almost impossible job and certainly one he wasn't particularly suited to. So now that he's got a bit more support, a bit more structure around him, I don't think it's coincidence that we're seeing more from him. It has been interesting over the past couple of weeks watching the pendulum swing as regarding Xhaka. You know, after the Liverpool game, everyone was full of praise for him, you know, raving about his performance. Then after Wolves, he was criticised again. The truth, of course, lies somewhere in the middle, and he is someone who I think you do have to kind of accept the rough with the smooth.
Yeah.
More, but I think, you know, he's being picked week in, week out, and I can't really argue with it. You know, I like Guendouzi, but I'm not in a place where I think he must come in at Xhaka's expense. I think we need to play two deepish holding midfielders. Torreira is going to be one, and I think Xhaka is the next best guy to be the other.
Yeah, we're not necessarily replete with options in midfield, are we? You know,
I mean, Guendouzi would be the one, wouldn't he? If you were going to say it's two from three, I think those are the three.
What's your opinion on Guendouzi? Like, I think he's looked really promising, but I'm also quite cautious about a young player coming through and talk of him being the future of the Arsenal midfield and everything else. I mean, I like the idea of it. If he's that good, I like the idea of it, but I do wonder how people are being that definitive this early in his career. I mean, is, you know, what we've seen from him generally has been really positive. But he still is just 19, isn't he? I mean, there's a need to not overdo the hype a bit.
What I would say is remember Danielson. That's what I would say. I mean, when Danielson broke into the Arsenal first team and when he first arrived, people were falling over themselves over this guy. Mm. You know, he was decent. It wasn't like they were doing it without justification. He was playing pretty well and seemed to be pretty competent in all aspects of the game. People saying, oh, we've got another Fabregas. Imagine playing these guys together. What are they going to be like? And as it was, his development sort of plateaued and he never really kicked on. He did eventually become a first-team player at Arsenal, but in a period where our midfield was really poor and we were exposed, essentially. Now, I'm not saying Guendouzi is going to go the same way, and there are definitely, I think, more eye-catching attributes within his game than Danielson ever had. He was kind of a sort of solid across-the-board player, but it was difficult to say what exactly he did well. I think Guendouzi's...
Run really slowly. I think he did that quite well.
Yeah, he could do that quite well. I think Guendouzi's energy, I think his range of passing are already superior to anything we saw from Danielson. But I share your caution, really, I suppose. I think we've been burnt many times as Arsenal fans by, you know, last season it was Ainsley Maitland-Niles, you know, people saying this guy is the solution. He's going to be, you know, the new Vieira or whatever it is, you know, the next big thing in central midfield. Now Guendouzi's come along, people aren't really talking about Maitland-Niles anymore. We have a tendency as fans, don't we, to jump on board the train of whoever's hot right then. And I think in Guendouzi's case, the manager's enormous faith in him, which in the first few weeks of the season we all found, I think, quite surprising, has made us think, well, if he's picking him, he must be seeing something remarkable there. And I think that's what informs it. You know, this isn't a guy who sort of had to bide his time in the under-19s or under-23s. He's being selected for the first team despite not seemingly having much of a pedigree coming into the club. I wouldn't put my house on Guendouzi being a, you know, international great. I just think it's impossible to say, really.
Just a little bit of time, I think, is
but,
needed.
But let me ask you this. Do you think he's, like, say a Maitland-Niles or say an Elneny, like, do you think he is justifiably above those guys in the pecking order?
Maitland-Niles is a difficult one because he was injured. I thought it was interesting that when he played this season in the Europa League, he was played as part of the front three, which is where he spent a lot of his time at youth level. He was a winger. Elneny... Emery clearly sees more in Guendouzi than Elneny. There's no question about that. Otherwise, he would play a more experienced player. You know, when you think about that first game of the season, and he picks him against Manchester City, he picks him against Chelsea, that's a real show of faith. I wonder in some ways, is it because he is 19 and he doesn't really have any fear and there weren't any expectations on him, you can't say it's a pressure-free environment to go in and play like that, but you know, you're given the leeway of being a new guy coming up from League Two and nobody's really expecting a great deal from you. He plays without fear, which is nice to see. There are things that he can improve on and he will improve on as he goes on. And I think he's probably now, is he the third choice central midfield player behind Xhaka and Guendouzi? The others are making their way behind him. Ramsey, Maitland-Niles, maybe, if he's going to play there. Elneny is just a squad player right at this moment in time. So, you know, I'm hopeful about Guendouzi. I just don't quite get the definitive way some people talk about him and what he's going to be at Arsenal. Because, like you say, we have seen players come in, do well as a young player because there is that freedom, you know, and as soon as there is a bit more expectation and a bit more pressure and a need to provide consistency, it becomes more difficult. So,
Did you see, there was kind of a video doing the rounds on Twitter where someone had taken, I think it's an existing viral video about Gordon Ramsay, where he's being really horrible to adult chefs, you know, on Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares. And then he's got a kid's show and he's sort of disturbingly lovely to these children. And they overlaid it with Arsenal fans react to certain players.
Yeah, it was very good. I retweeted that. It was good.
And if you haven't seen it, it's worth a watch because it's a nice illustration of the way in which we judge players differently. I mean, for example, if Guendouzi had made that mistake against Wolves, I suspect he would have had a very, very different reception to Granit Xhaka. And of course, there are reasons why he's not a regular offender yet in that case. But it is interesting how as a fan base, we seem to almost collectively kind of make a judgment about a player, and it does inform how we perceive them. It's interesting how that happens, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess. But, you know, it is one of those things, isn't it? When a new player comes in, they have this honeymoon period in a way. And then over time, you realise, okay, the hopes and expectations that I placed on this player when we signed him. Like, I think every player that we sign is going to be great. I've had that since I was a kid. Every time Arsenal, well, there must be a reason Arsenal are signing this player. He must be really good. Must be. And then it doesn't always work out that way. Quite often it doesn't work out that way. You know, the honeymoon period is over. The player doesn't meet the expectations, or he can't live up to the standards either that we ascribe to him or that we require. In real life, we actually require this player to be better. And off he goes, and a new one comes in, and you do the same thing. This guy's going to be fucking great. Look at him. He's a monster. He's the physical specimen we need. You know, and then all of a sudden you realize, well, he's not that good at football. That's a shame.
Yeah, that is basically the pattern, and has been the pattern all too often recently. I don't wish to make it sound like we're not impressed by Guendouzi.
No, not at all.
He's definitely exceeded, I think, anybody's expectations of him coming into the club. But I do also think a bit of caution is worthwhile too, because I have seen other players look fantastic in those first few months and been wrong. Been very, very wrong. One thing I thought we should touch on just before the end of part one is, I don't know if you've how much attention you've been paying, but the Arsenal women's team are really good.
I obviously have been reading the stuff that Tim Stillman is doing on Arseblog News, and yes, they are. They're top of the league, aren't they?
8 consecutive victories, I believe. They won 4-0 yesterday against Everton, and they're just scoring goals for fun. If you ever sort of tire of our somewhat pedestrian attacking that we've seen in the past couple of games, it's worth checking them out because they're a brilliant team going forward. They've got an excellent striker called Viviane Miedema, who has scored about 100 goals already this season. Now, I think she's generally into double figures. It's quite impressive. And they are, the way the Women's Super League is structured, I think the top three, who are sort of Chelsea, Man City and Arsenal, are sort of are breaking away from the rest of the pack already, but Arsenal very much in there and having a real resurgence. So it's definitely, and they're playing some fantastic football as well. In sort of
some of the goals,
Tim has called. Yeah, I know. Well, Tim has spoken about how the managers wanted to kind of play in the Arsenal tradition, which I suppose is, you know, the style of football that Arsene Wenger implemented, and with that Arsenal style. And they really are. So, yeah, well, if you get a moment, do go back. There are highlights, if you're in Britain, available on the BBC website. So go back and check those out.
Do they have clips on the Arsenal? I presume they must have some clips on the Arsenal website as well, no?
They probably do. I don't know. But I know the BBC have the rights over here.
And if you are local enough that you want to go and see some of the games, Tim has written a really good post on Arseblog News, which I'll add the link to in the description of the podcast on the website. You can find out, you know, where they play, how to get tickets, etc., etc. I think it's great. It's fantastic that the women's team are doing so well, and also fantastic that there's more coverage of it. We do as much as we can on Arseblog News. Tim does fantastic stuff on that as well. So it's great, and it has actually, I've seen people feedback on the posts and on Twitter to Tim to say, look, I, I really didn't know anything about the women's team. I'm now following, or I'm bringing my kids to watch the women's team. So it's driving interest and more fans towards the women's team and women's football, which is absolutely great. So
yeah, that's really cool.
And the great thing is, if you don't like women's football, you don't have to do anything at all. You can just ignore it.
Exactly. Yeah, there's no need for inflammatory comments on Facebook or anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. All right, we're going to take a break. It's the end of part one. We'll come back with part two, which is what? The bit where we do the questions. That's it. I was trying to figure out what it was.
Yeah, this is the bit where they tell us what to say. So thank goodness, you know, we can go into autopilot now. It's all down to the listeners.
Exactly.
The responsibility's firmly on you guys.
All the research and preparation we did for this first bit that took us so long.
It's over.
It's over. Thank goodness. And we can hand it over to you guys right after this.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. Welcome back to the Arscast Extra. This is part two of the show where we answer questions you send to us on Twitter at Gunnarblog and at Arsblog, and also on the Arsblog Facebook page, facebook.com/ the Arsblog. Right, I'm going to start because this one comes from Hakon Larsen, who's at Hakon Larsen 92. And he says, "What is your honest opinion on XG? Have the stat people taken it too far? It seems like it's so much focus before and after games, and people can't be happy with a performance because of bad XG. What is going on?"
Yeah, I saw this question as well. And I also had this question from Adrova Cedric, who said, "Looking at the stats with XG and all the stuff, it looks like we are overperforming
the
quite
stuff,
lucky.
All the
yeah.
stuff.
Are you worrying about it?"
I mean, always worried about stuff. You know, all the stuff I'm worried about. All the stuff.
I think that XG is an illustrative stat, but not a definitive stat. In that, I think it helps you. It helps you to get more information about a game, to get more of a bigger picture of a game. But I don't think it tells you the story of a game in its entirety. But that applies to any stat. It's the same as possession or chances or corners. You know, it's informative without being definitive. And I do think that there are people who think that XG, there are kind of XG fanatics out there who are like, well, the score is almost less significant than the XG. You know, the XG is the real determinant of performance. I don't feel that way about it. But I do think that it can help you to sort of, I guess, fill in the gaps of the story of a match, but it does not define that story. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I know what you mean. All of this stuff, all of this stuff that I worry about so much. No, it's just added information, isn't it? So James went to the shops is the same as Arsenal 1, Liverpool 0. Right?
Right.
Right. But when you start adding stats into the equation here, you find out that when James went to the shops, he got stopped by a granny who he helped across the road. His expected crossing of the road is part of his journey to the shops. Right?
Right, yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
And stats are kind of like that too. You get the result, but how many times did we help a granny cross the road in the 90 minutes versus Liverpool? That's the added colour, which informs your understanding of the 1-0. Does that make sense?
Kind of. Yeah, it kind of does. I mean, to be honest, it's mainly granny's helping me across the road with my luck. You know, I sort of think I'm the one who needs assistance in that situation. But basically, I think that what XG does do is it sort of... Like, for example, this season, we've been really efficient with our finishing. Like, we have overperformed our XG, I believe, in terms of goal scoring. A lot of players have.
Maybe it's come back to the mean now a little bit because of the last few games.
Sure, but at a certain point, we were... But there is something to be said for that, though. I don't think you can just write off efficient finishing as a statistical aberration. You know, I think that you have to also look at that as like a positive rather than an outlier. Do you know what I mean there? Like,
yeah,
it doesn't. And also, there are sort of flaws within XG. You know, sometimes you hear people break down a game in terms of XG and they'll be like, oh, well, that chance, you'll look at chance, you'll be like, well, that was a really good chance. And they'll be like, yeah, but in XG terms, it actually wasn't that good a chance because, you know, the XG doesn't factor in the position of the goalkeeper or something like that, where it's clearly still an imperfect system. But I do think it's helpful. I mean, did you watch, in fact... We had a question. Ricardo Coral T says, did you get to watch Arsene's interview on beIN Sports? And if so, anything that caught your attention? Have you seen that?
No, not yet. I loaded it and then I remembered that it was Richard Keys and Andy Gray. And that put me off it.
Yeah, that element of it is uncomfortable, I'll be honest. Especially because he seems to be quite pally with them. And, you know, no one wants that. Nobody wants that. But there is an interesting part in it where he says the job of the modern manager, he said, you come in at half time and you're overloaded with data. You know, you get so much more data now than you did even 10 years ago. And he said a big part of the job is choosing the three numbers that you will implement into your halftime team talk that you think can make a positive impact upon the team. Sifting through all the data and going, well, these are the things that are pertinent. And I guess sometimes that will be something like XG, and sometimes it won't.
So, okay, so halftime whistle goes, and the manager makes his way down the tunnel. Is there a stats guy giving him a brief on the game?
That's certainly what he implies, yeah.
Right, that's interesting. That's interesting. I mean, look, again, I just think stats are a way of understanding more about what's going on. Without, you know, the people who live at the extremes where stats are the be-all and end-all, or the people who don't think stats are in any way important, you know, 1-0, that's the only stat you need.
Sure.
You know, that kind of thing isn't particularly helpful, but if it helps you understand things a little better, better. You know, I think the data that they have is much more sophisticated than we have, certainly. You know, how many runs a player makes, sprints a player makes, where is he making those runs?
Definitely.
But on XG, it's interesting. I think it's interesting, but like you say, it doesn't always tell the full story of a game.
I think basically it's a better stat than attempts on goal, isn't it? Because anyone can have an attempt on goal from, you know, Andros Townsend can have as many attempts on goal as he likes from 30 yards, but they're not, you know, they rarely actually have an impact in terms of how they influence games. So I think it does illustrate to you how effective you are being going forward, the types of chance you are creating. I think that's definitely a positive and useful thing. However, I'm not at a point where I come out of games and I look at the full-time score and I go, yeah, but what was the XG? You know, I still am led by the score because it's the emotive thing, isn't it? I mean, that's the sort of thing that we actually get excited about.
Sure.
But I don't think it's gone too far. In fact, I think it's going to go a hell of a lot further. And I think that, you know, stats and numbers are here to stay, aren't they? There's not going to be any... it's not going to be a let-up in terms of that. In fact, I think they're going to become more and more sophisticated.
It would be a bit of a problem if they did away with numbers. Because we need them on a daily basis.
And on the back of the players' shirts as well. It'd be very difficult to tell them apart.
It would, unless they all got like a little icon, like emojis.
That's probably the future. I tell you another thing Arsene said in his interview, and you've probably seen these quotes flying around, but he's really banging the drum for, not banging the drum for it, he's sounding the warning, let's say, for before long, half-time substitutions will be made by fans on social media. I mean, do you think that is plausible?
There's a lot of stuff that's happened in this world recently that I thought was completely and utterly implausible. So I'm loath to rule anything out. You know, ideas that seemed ludicrous came to pass and exist, even if they still feel ludicrous. So would I rule it out? I mean, I think it would be fucking stupid. I think it would be a really terrible, terrible thing. But is it impossible? I don't know. If they get it sponsored by somebody, halftime substitution sponsored by Domino's Pizza. Use your Domino's app to vote for which player you want to take off and which one, and you get a voucher for fucking 20% off a pizza. That's not impossible.
I mean, now I'm interested. But
only if it was good pizza. Go on.
Was it Ebbsfleet United who was subject to a takeover where basically everyone bought a share and you did sort of run the club as a kind of cooperative, like a collective, where there were kind of votes on stuff like new managers and things like that. I'm not sure if it was Ebbsfleet or not, but My Football Club, there you go. November 2007, the website My Football Club entered a deal in principle to take over Ebbsfleet United. So it was a 700,000 takeover fund. And members had a vote on transfers as well as player selection and all major decisions. I mean, it was an absolute unmitigated disaster. There's some very good pieces. If you Google My Football Club Ebbsfleet, there are some great pieces sort of documenting the downfall of that. I think in the space of 5 years, the club ended up very close to going out of business by 2012, and they were eventually bailed out by Kuwaiti Group, I think. But yeah, I mean, it was quite extraordinary how, like, there were 32,000 people signed up and it was 9,000 within 2 years. You know, people just had no long-term interest in it. I mean, anyway, I think it's a sort of salutary warning to football clubs about these kinds of things. I mean, imagine opening up decision-making about the Arsenal first team to Arsenal Twitter.
It'd be absurd. Look, I don't really think it's going to happen because who would be a football manager? Who would dedicate that kind of time to a job if a bunch of fucking wankers on social media could, you know, push buttons and basically make your job redundant or make your job more difficult? Because like anything, it could be exploited, couldn't it? You know, when you think
of
about
course.
It, it could absolutely...
The Russians would be making the decisions, you mean?
Russian troll farms would be like, all of a sudden, who are we going to take off? Aubameyang, but he scored four goals in that half. And who are we putting on? Holy shit, I don't know who we could put on.
If you bring on Petr Cech up front, exactly.
That kind of stuff, yeah. So it's not going to happen, but I don't know what to say about this, other than, like... It can't possibly happen, but if it did, I wouldn't also be that surprised. Sometime in the distant future. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
Right. Well, I mean, I'd like to think that any manager would be too principled to, you know, take a job under those circumstances. But who knows? If they're being paid enough, who knows?
Yeah, exactly. Is it my question? Okay, I've got one here. I did have one. Okay, this is quite an interesting one. It comes from Niranjan Kulkarni, who's at Nisius00004 on Twitter. And he says, individual player rating out of 10 for the season so far. So I'm guessing that's for each player. We give him a rating out of 10. So we could do this one pretty quickly, I think. If we go through... Let me go through the squad here and we'll see... We'll see where we end up with this. So, let me just get up the team here. We'll just go through the first team. Petr Cech, what would you give him out of 10?
I'd give him a 7, maybe.
Okay.
You?
I think that's reasonable based on what he did. Bernd Leno?
I think I'd give him a 7 as well.
Oh, would you?
Yeah,
I think I'd give him an 8.
I was thinking 8, but then I thought he has made a couple of errors, but they just haven't been punished maybe as severely as Cech.
Yeah.
No, I'll go with you. Okay, 8. Yeah, I can see it.
Okay. You don't have to agree. You know, it's fine. You can stick with your 7. You can be harsher if you like.
I don't want to get into half numbers because
we've
got to
do halves.
You've got to do halves.
I think you can't do player ratings without halves. Because sometimes,
the policy, isn't it?
I think, because we did them for ESPN.
Yeah, no
for
halves,
a long
it?
Time. And they had a no halves policy, which I think is wrong. Because player ratings, let's remember, are completely subjective opinions for entertainment purposes. Really.
Yeah.
So you've got to be able to give somebody a half if you want.
Fine. If I could do halves, I'll give them half. 7.5.
Seven and a half. I'm sticking with an 8. Hector Bellerin.
Do you know what's tricky about this? Is that in my mind, I've given a 7 to Petr Cech. That's now 7. Do you see what I mean? So everything's sort of relative to that. So I've got no idea sort of where I'm going to go with this. I think Hector Bellerin, I'm actually going to give Hector Bellerin an 8.
Right. Okay. I'm going to give him a 7.5. I think he's been good.
Yeah.
Socrates?
Really difficult one, that.
I'm going to go 6.
I'm going to go 6.5.
Okay.
6.5.
6 is kind of my baseline. That's where I start from, you know, when I give
That's
ratings.
Like out on par.
Yeah, exactly, on par. I don't think we've seen enough. Stefan Lichtsteiner.
Oh, I think quite bad from me. I'm going to say five.
Yeah, I'd go with a 5 for Lichtsteiner.
I was tempted by 4.5, I'll be honest, but
right.
I went for 5.
Okay, Rob Holding, I'm going to give a 7 to Rob Holding.
Same, 7 for me. Yeah, pretty decent.
Nacho Monreal, I think 6.
Really? I think that's a bit low.
Do you? I just think he's been injured. Maybe he's a bit out of sight, out of mind for me. I think he's our best left back.
I think when he's played.
Yeah. But maybe you have to take all of that into the equation.
I'd say for me, when he's played, he's been a 7.
Okay, I'll go 6.5, maybe. Mustafi.
What did I give Lichtsteiner? A 5.
5.
I think 5, probably, for me.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, he's had some good games.
He's had some good games, that's the problem, but it's sort of not convincing enough and too many errors in there, so I think for me it is a 5.
Carl Jenkinson, I don't think we can rate because he hasn't really played enough. Kolasinac, Is he sort of in the same situation in that he hasn't played enough and he's only just come back from injury? Still going to give him a five, though.
He'd be a five, yeah. I mean, he's not really made a positive, particularly positive contribution.
Elneny.
I mean, he is the most six player in the world, isn't he? I mean, yeah. He's Mr. Six. But it's difficult because he's only played in the cup games. And he's not been bad.
He's not been great, though.
No, maybe he is a six. I mean, in terms of his contribution, he's less than that. But when he's actually been on the pitch, he's been perfectly acceptable. So I would say six, I think.
Okay. I'll go with a six as well for Elneny, just because he hasn't done anything particularly brilliantly, but nothing particularly wrong. Henrik Mkhitaryan. I think I'll go a 6.5 for Mkhitaryan because he has these moments which are excellent, but I just feel there's so much of what happens passes him by, which is frustrating for me. You know, for a player of 29, you just expect a little bit more. So a 6.5.
6.5, I actually am going to agree with you on that one. Yeah, I think that's about right.
Aaron Ramsey.
That's a difficult one to assess, isn't it? Mm. Because he's not been starting regularly. He hasn't really got a defined position in the team, but he has made a couple of positive contributions.
Most assists in the Premier League for Arsenal this season alongside Hector Bellerin with 4.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that does speak to how good Bellerin's been partly. 4 assists?
Yeah.
You have to wonder, don't you?
And goal of the month, probably goal of the season.
Yeah. But then I wouldn't look at it and say he's played particularly well in many games. I think for him, I think I'm going to have to say, I want to give him a really low mark because I have really high expectations of him. And I feel like he's underperformed against those. But I don't know if that's unfair.
Yeah, I was going to give him a 5.5 because he's been below par, but is still contributed. And the circumstances, there's a weirdness about his entire situation, isn't there?
I think 5.5 is probably right. What about Mesut Ozil?
This is a difficult one.
Well, if we do it on one game, he can have a 10.
I think based on his talent, his ability, his creativity, I think he gets a 5 from me.
Yeah.
Because he was brilliant against Leicester. It was Leicester, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was absolutely fantastic. But he just hasn't imposed himself on games. Someone said to me a while ago that Ozil is a kind of player that needs other great players around him to be really at his best or for the team to be playing really, really well, which I don't think is unfair. But I just think based on the responsibility he's got, the captain's armband, you have to take into account his wage packet. What did you make of the stories by Ozil's agent to say that he had turned down £1 million a week from China because Arsenal was the only place he wanted to be? Do you believe that?
Not really. Mm. Not really. I think that the money in China is... they've come down on it a bit, haven't they? I think the government has sort of slightly tightened up on regulations there to stop there being this exorbitant gap between the Western players who come over and the rest of the Chinese league. I would be surprised by that. And also, I don't think it's a helpful thing to say because what you're doing is you're... Although you are appearing to try and make the decision about more than money, you are just talking about money. Mm. And I feel like that's a bit of a sensitive subject around Mesut Ozil at the moment. You know, I think he is in a position where his every performance is kind of compared to his pay packet.
Yeah.
And I think drawing attention to that is probably an unwise move. But he's quite spiky, Ozil's agent, and when he senses his client is under pressure, he does tend to come out with stuff.
I do wonder if it was a way to make it look as if accepting the mere £350,000 a week from Arsenal was in some ways Ozil, like, he should be commended for this. You know, look at what he turned down.
I don't think any other player of that caliber would contemplate a move to China. That's the thing.
But so I don't think anyone would turn down £1 million a week if the next best offer was £350,000 a week. I'm sorry. I just don't believe that to be the case, particularly when you're a player heading.
Who's won the World Cup.
He's won the World Cup. You're 30 years of age and someone offers you £1 million a week in a 3-year contract. Nah. Anyway, I think a 5 for me for Ozil, but a 10 for that Leicester performance.
Yeah, but I don't think we'd. I don't think we'd necessarily discuss any other player in those terms. I think 5 as well. I think 5 as well.
Lucas Torreira.
Torreira. What have we done? So my highest so far has been 8 for Hector Bellerin. I'm probably going to go one better, say 8.5 for Torreira.
Okay.
He's been excellent.
Yeah, he has. I would give him an 8. I feel like perhaps there is a bit of new player bias going on there.
Of course.
But hey, these are just ratings for entertainment purposes. Guendouzi.
Maitland-Niles, we can't really do, can no. we? I think it'd be a bit harsh. Guendouzi, I would say... I think I would say 7.5 from me.
Okay, I'd go a 7. 7.
Okay.
Granit Xhaka?
Granit Xhaka, I think I'm going to say 7.5 as well, I think.
6.84 for me.
For you?
Yeah.
Okay. That's our biggest discrepancy, probably.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe I think he could get a 7. Maybe. If I'm feeling generous.
I didn't know we were doing 0.84s, you know. I need to go back. There's a few 0.84s I want to put in.
You can use any decimal between 1 and 100 if you like. I don't know. We'll stick with halves. We'll stick with halves, so I'll round
six.
I'll round Xhaka up to a 7 on that basis. Right. Lacazette.
I think he's done pretty well, actually, and better than I anticipated. I think I'm going to give him a 7.5.
Okay. I think a 7 for me. He scored some fantastic goals and he's become the focal point of the attack, but the attack hasn't always worked, particularly in the last few weeks. So I think a 7.
I hear you. I just rarely feel like he is the reason the attack hasn't worked. I think it's what's done with the three behind him.
I tend to agree with that as well. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Aubameyang.
7.
Hard one to assess. Lots of goals. Lots of goals.
Lots of goals, but performances and contributions generally. I mean, what do you want from him? He scores goals. That's it. That's what he does. But, and a 7 with the caveat that I don't think it's necessarily his fault that it's not higher because of what's going on with, him playing out on the left all the time. So, yeah.
I would agree with you. 7 for Aubameyang.
Alex Iwobi? I'm going 6.5 for Iwobi.
Yeah, it's one where, like, in my mind, I think people might expect it to be higher. But actually, I think it's more about how much he's improved relative to last season than he's suddenly Ronaldinho. Do you know what I mean? So I would give him a 7, I think. But that is a big step forward for him.
Yeah.
Okay,
and Danny Welbeck, finally.
Well, finally. I mean, you know, sad because we might not see him again this for some time, but I think he probably deserves a 7 from me, actually, in terms of what he's done in the games that he's played.
Yeah.
So I'd say 7 for Welbeck.
5 goals or whatever it was before he picked up the injury, so I think he has contributed. And I suppose the thing to point out about ratings is that the ratings aren't necessarily in comparison with other players. It's what you expect from that player themselves, where they're performing in relation to their own ability and the job that they're being asked to do. So Aubameyang getting a 7 despite scoring more goals doesn't negate the Welbeck 7, if that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely. What's interesting, I suppose, going through that is there aren't too many players who've had shockers, are there? You know, there aren't too many, you're saying, 4 or 5. There are only a few below 6. So
yeah.
I think that does speak to the fact that Unai Emery is getting more out of this squad. He's getting something decent out of it.
We're doing all right. Not spectacularly, but all right.
Yeah, we're doing okay.
Okay. Your question?
My question. Let's have a little look, see what we've got. XG, done that. Be in Sports, done that. Ratwan Postwala says, I reckon Koscielny will be back after the interlow, and that makes me really happy. Assuming he's able to stay fit and be first choice, how would you rank our remaining centre-backs in order of their suitability to be his centre-back partner? And then he says, I'd go Socrates, Holding, Mavropanos, and lastly, Mustafi.
I've got issues with Mustafi. I think people who listen regularly will know that, but I love the idea of a 19-year-old who's been injured all season
is ahead of him in the
pecking order. I'd like, again, like Guendouzi, I'd like Mavropanos to come through and be outstanding, but we just haven't seen enough of him. You know, the last time we saw him, he got sent off at the end of last season, and that's basically the last time we've seen him. Didn't really feature in preseason, so, you know, I think we need to step back a little bit on Mavropanos. Where do I rate them? I don't know. I don't think Koscielny is necessarily going to come back as a first choice. Maybe he will, but he is 32, 33 now off the back of a big injury. So it's really hard to say what way it's going to work. I think just having four centre halves will be useful, though. You know, we've got three and we're playing three times a week, you know, with league games and Europa League games. And there's no way of properly resting everyone because you're having to play at least one of those centre halves in every game. So it might make Emery's job a little bit easier when it comes to the Europa League. So, I don't know how to rate them. I'd like to see Socrates and Holding get a little run of games. Not because I'm especially confident in it, but just because we haven't seen it.
I think that's absolutely fair enough. Yeah, I think that we've been wondering sort of why Socrates hasn't been in the team as much, and I do think it's because Emery seems to have decided that he and Mustafi are not a particularly compatible balanced partnership. However, that if that means Rob Holding's going to play, then I would prefer to see Socrates in there to Mustafi. But I don't think we'll see Mustafi and Socrates together very much moving forward. It almost feels like that decision has been taken now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does a bit. Shall we do a few quickfire ones to finish off? Because we've been going through here. Kwame Odum, who's at Kwame Odum, says, what are Emi Martinez's chances of making it at Arsenal?
Very slim. Slim to none at this point,
yeah,
I'd say.
I would
especially
agree.
Given the relative ages of Martinez and Leno.
Yeah. Yeah, they're the same age, more or less.
Wow. Pretty much, yeah.
I think, let me...
So Leno's 26, I believe.
Yeah, and Emi Martinez is also 26.
Wow. So, that September, speaks volumes, doesn't it?
Yeah, he was 26 in September, and Bernd Leno was 26 in March. Bernd Leno has played 350, nearly 400 first-team games. Emi Martinez has not played 50 yet. So that tells you, I think, a story. Go on. Have you got one?
Yeah, and Nathan Rich says, would it be unthinkable to try Lacazette on the left-hand side with Aubameyang through the middle?
Wouldn't be unthinkable, but I presume there's a good reason why we haven't done it yet.
Nathan's thoughts are that Laka's more comfortable with the ball at his feet, and he played okay in that position last season at one point. I think it was the Leicester game, wasn't it? He was thrown there and Giroud went through the middle. But
yeah. I don't think it's an ideal solution to what is a problem that we have in terms of how we pick our team.
Yeah.
You know, again, it's playing somebody else out of position. So I don't know.
I agree with you.
Lyle Buckenjohn, who's at Invisigooner, says, which positions would be a priority in this upcoming transfer window, and are we looking for starters or squad players? So do you think we'll sign anyone in January?
No, I don't.
Yeah, me neither.
If I was in the market, I'd be looking at left backs I'd be looking at...
You'd be looking at Ben Chilwell, James. Let's just lay it on the...
Chilwell.
You are obsessed with this young man.
But I am dangerously obsessed with Ben Chilwell, who was very good again for England. But I genuinely think he is out of our reach. I do think that we have to be the club that signs Ben Chilwell 2 years ago.
We were not gonna. He was on our radar. I think there were reports that he, before he signed a new deal with Leicester, we were going to bring him in. And
yeah,
something happened. Well, Kolasinac, I guess.
Kolasinac, maybe, or maybe it was this. You know, yeah, we thought we were switching to a back three, something like that. I don't know, but I do think that we're not necessarily a club who can go buy someone who's now an England first team player, essentially, on a 5 year contract. I don't, you know, I think we need to find, crazily, the next Ben Chilwell.
Mm. Good luck with that.
Yeah. And so left back would be on my list, and I suppose wide forward would be on my list. Although okay. We've talked about Reece Nelson a lot as well.
Okay. Have you got one? I've got a couple.
Have you got?
I've
got on your list?
Yeah, I've got a. What would be on my list? Yeah, I'd like a left back. I think we have to really address the left back position. Where else?
I mean, I'm still would take. I know we've got loads of them, but if a world top class centre half became available, you know, of course that would still be on my wish list as well.
Yes, me too. Me too. But don't worry, we've got Mavropanos. Nazar Timol, who's at Radiohead Tim, says, what do you guys make of the reports linking us with a loan move for Ousmane Dembele? You see, Guillaume Balaguer is saying that via an intermediary, Arsenal have asked Barcelona about a loan move for the man who's having a very difficult time in Catalonia. He's turning up late for training, turning up late for games, getting fined. Doesn't seem to be having a happy time at Barcelona.
No, I mean, it's a little bit like the sort of stuff we were hearing about Aubameyang prior to his January move to Arsenal. I would be surprised, though, just because he was such a massive investment, I would be surprised if Barcelona sanctioned a loan deal for him. It would be... I mean, they'd be not cutting their losses, but he cost, I think, £100 million, essentially.
Yeah. You don't tend to loan out £100 million players, do you?
No. Apparently, there's some stories going around that they fear that he's got a sort of gaming addiction.
Hang on, what? Gaming or gambling?
Gaming, computer games.
So he's what, like playing Fortnite all the time or what? What's he playing?
Apparently, that's one of the reasons he missed training, because he was up all night. According to AS, who we know only print the truth,
yeah.
He missed training because he was up playing, yeah, let's say it was Fortnite or FIFA or whatever it was all
right.
Night.
Wow.
Look, he's obviously a top player. This story's been rumbling around for about a year now, hasn't it? That he's not settled at Barcelona and that we might be in the market for him. I mean, he has played for Dortmund, so there is a possibility that Sir Mr. Tapwood could contemplate signing him. How's Malcolm getting on at Barcelona? Because he was a year ago being talked up as an Arsenal player, wasn't he?
Yeah, I don't know, actually.
I feel like he's not getting on particularly great either, and they're both kind of left-footed right-wingers who I feel like aren't really having any sort of positive impact there.
Well, he has made, according to transfermarkt.com, he has made just three appearances in La Liga with no goals. One appearance in the Champions League, in which he scored a goal, and one appearance in the Copa del Rey. So this is a Barcelona team in a kind of transition still, isn't it? Mm. Or it's going through a sort of transition after Iniesta's gone and what have you. So it's not working out particularly well for him.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you ask me if I'd like Ousmane Dembele, the answer is definitely yes.
Okay.
But I'm not taking it too seriously as a story right now. Troy Reed, who's at TroyReed32, asks, once opened, does tomato sauce or ketchup belong in the cupboard or fridge?
We did this. We did this years ago. I can't remember what we said, but I think it stays in the cupboard. I don't put it in the fridge.
I agree. That's fine. That's good. Who wants cold ketchup on the chips?
Okay.
Nobody. Right.
James Carter 100. What's your favourite, if any, football-watching snack?
Oh. Well, at the Emirates, nothing, because the food is so crazily overpriced. If I was at home... football.
I don't eat
during the football.
No, me neither.
It's too distracting. You have to look down and all that.
Like, I have food at, like, meal times. You know, I have breakfast and then there might be a game, or you have lunch and there might be a game. You have dinner. I don't necessarily sit down and eat while football is on at all.
No.
So there you go.
I'm more like to have a drink during the football.
Yeah, exactly.
Than an eat.
Definitely not stadium food, though, as well. I don't understand people who complain about stadium food as well. You know? God, the fucking burger's overpriced and it's terrible. What do you expect?
You
it's being made.
It.
It's a football stadium.
I know.
What are you expecting?
I have eaten at the stadium food before, but only in times of desperation.
I can understand somebody, if they get to the ground and they've been racing to the ground straight from work and they haven't had a chance to have something to eat and you're starving. But, you know, don't go in looking for Michelin-starred food or value for money. Same with any stadium, isn't it?
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, Arsenal, the calibre of the stadium food has improved fractionally, but the price has risen dramatically. So, no, not for me.
Okay. Do I have any more? Terrier Blog wants to know, should Man City be condemned for their financing and the questionable regime that backs them? Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Problem solved.
Yeah, they've got a great PR team, though, so it doesn't happen. So, But yes, they really should. Final one, Frederick Anderson, who's F. Anderson 90. Would you rather spend the rest of your life in need of a wee or the rest of your life with an itch on your arm?
Itch on the arm.
Yeah, me too.
Itch on the arm.
You could always cut your arm off, couldn't you? Problem solved.
Exactly. Yeah.
And get a robot hand. Do, 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 do. Robot hand, which could then rig the results of the halftime Twitter poll to see which player is going to be substituted, because it would be all like technology arm. Be great.
If you needed a Wii, but you cut your Mickey off, would you stop needing a Wii?
No, because that's not what makes you need a Wii. It's your bladder being full. So you'd have to rip out
your
own bladder.
You'd have to rip out your
own bladder. That would not be good, because then all the Wii would just go... It would just go...
Gush out.
No, it would just go down into your legs. It would just, like, because there's no bladder to hold it in, it would just go down your legs and you'd have enormous piss-filled thighs as you walked along the street. You'd just be sloshing around...
Horrible.
Although
like
I suppose, suppose you could like you lop off your toe as a kind of a tap. You could just open up your toe and it would all just flow out on the street.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
I think that is how bodies work.
Yeah.
I'll still go with the itchy arm, but it's fine. My arm itches all the time, you know.
You can scratch it.
You can scratch it with the other one. Perfect.
All right. Well, look, I hope that you enjoyed this podcast to an extent as much as possible during this international break. It's been quiet, but we did our best. We did our best for you guys.
I enjoyed doing it.
All right. Well, then, if you're happy...
Then it doesn't matter, really, does it?
Well, of course it matters.
As we're having no time.
Thank you, as ever, for listening. Football is back this weekend. We go to Bournemouth on Sunday, so we'll look forward to that on the Arsecast Extra. As well, look out for a new series of podcasts coming to our Patreon page, patreon.com/arseblog. I will give you some details on that this week in a post. James and I will be looking for your input into these podcasts as well. So if you're a Patreon member, keep an eye out for that. If you're not, you can sign up for a fiver a month at patreon.com/arseblog, and we'll catch you on the next one. Until then,
bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.